Hey, I'm Brian Hyatt. This is Rolling Stone Music Now. Happy New Year. Today we're going to kick in the first show of 2020 with an interview recently conducted by my colleague Patrick Doyle with the Black Keys, and that's Dan Auerbach and Patrick Carney. And they talked about the Keys' whole career. They're back after a three-year break with a new album. And there's a lot in there, so let's get right to it.
People are saying that you guys are better performers now than you ever were.
We have a street team on YouTube commenting for us.
Yeah.
Actually, Dan sent me a link after, I think we played Toronto, and he sent me a link from a clip of us playing Low High that night. And there was one comment, and it said, "I'm so glad I didn't come to your show because you would have ruined the song for me. I myself have a band and cover the song, and there's just so many nuances to the song."
Yeah, you said you're really not doing justice, though.
We're doing justice to our own song. I was like, this is exactly what's wrong with the world today, is that this fucking idiot has a voice. You know what I mean? Like, I think this is basically like David from The Office, or whatever, Steve
Carell. David Brand?
Yeah, from The Office, leaving comments on motherfuckers' YouTube page.
Tell me about the first time you got into the room together and plugged in after 5 years, that basically 5 years that you hadn't played together after playing together for so long.
Well, let's just get that piece of information straight. It was 3 years that we took a break.
Right.
Our last show together was at Outside Lands
in
San Francisco in 2015. And within a couple of weeks, Dan was on the road with the Arcs.
Mm-hmm.
And that lasted about a year, and then he went into a solo record, and we basically took 3 years off of the Keys, which is, I don't think, that crazy.
No.
You know what I mean? And people like asking if we had broken up or something. Really, we just, for the first time, took a normal person's break.
Yeah. It's weird because, well, you Google the Black Keys, the first thing is like, have the Black Keys broken up?
Right. Well, that's also our interns just trying to build up our street team out there working. You know, we took a break for the first time, and because you got to remember, between 2014 and 2002, we made 8 albums.
Yeah,
just 12 years. I mean, that's like a lot of records.
Yeah,
that's more than most bands get to make, you know. But when we decided to get back and make another record, we came back here in September of 2018, and we hadn't been in the studio together in probably 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
But we learned how to do this together, you know. So when we sat down.
But we'd also been working constantly.
I know.
So when Pat showed up, like, his drums were set up. Like, he had all new drums, all new stuff. Everything was like, he'd really been fine-tuning everything. Mm-hmm. And I'd been doing the same thing with all the guitar stuff. So when we sat down, we were so ready to go.
Yeah.
Almost more so than we'd ever been. It was just like, we didn't even have to talk about anything. We just started making music instantly, pretty much.
Yeah.
Well, we were talking about Keith Richards, and in his book he says that he will put down his instrument for sometimes years at a time.
Mm-hmm.
And because when he picks it up, he knows that he'll get something.
He has to hang out with his bandmates.
Yeah. Are you more creative when you haven't played for that long?
I've never not played for that long.
Yeah.
I'm always playing in some sort of way, I guess.
Yeah. You know?
A friend of mine just had surgery, a major surgery, abdominal surgery, and he's a drummer.
Yeah.
So we couldn't play for like 4 weeks. He said that was the longest break he's ever taken. And he's going to play again actually today. His doctor said he was allowed to. And I was like, well, I've definitely gone months at a time without playing the drums.
Mm-hmm.
And when I do sit down to play, I approach it differently.
Mm-hmm.
When I broke my shoulder, I had to stop playing for 4 months. So when I finally sat down, I realized, like, I think I just played a little bit better.
Yeah.
Couldn't do much of this extra strenuous movement, so I just was playing more simply. And I thought it was better.
In one of the early Rolling Stone stories, you went on a riff about how you don't consider yourself a good drummer. Is that true? Do you really believe that?
I mean, I don't consider myself a technical drummer.
Uh-huh.
You know, like, I think I'm a good drummer, but I don't think I'm a true drummer, guy that would come up here, like, just banging on everything, and being able to do, like, I play, like, 4-4 beats.
Yeah.
And I don't know. That's what I do.
Dan, you have played with a lot of different drummers. What's special about playing with Pat?
He's musical.
Yeah.
He's not like a drummer. He just, he approaches it differently, and he always has.
Mm-hmm.
And when we were starting, you know, I mean, there's just more space when it's just a, he's only playing with me.
Mm-hmm.
So he can fill up more space. He doesn't mm-hmm. have to, like, I don't know. He just kind of was able to be a little bit more free, I guess. And he's always been like that. He sets up his drums differently than other drummers, you know?
Mm-hmm. I learned to play drums almost specifically to play with Dan. You know what I mean? It was not like something I sat up to, like, learn how to do.
I mean, I can't tell you how many times that, like, the sound guy on stage has put Pat's floor tom on the other side of the drum kit, and he's mm-hmm. like, no, I put it over here.
Really?
Yeah. To this day, like, someone's like, how do you mic your drums up in stereo? I'm like, I just don't do that. I don't really know.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, we truly learned to play music together, and, you know, but the last 5 years, Dan's right, we have spent a lot of time working on other people's music, producing stuff, writing stuff with other people.
Listening, doing a lot of listening.
Yeah. Reassessing stuff that.
Oh yeah.
That maybe, you know, just going back and paying attention to stuff. So yeah, when we started making this record, it came pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the only thing we had to figure out as far as the band was how to make it functional without being like so time consuming that we wouldn't be able to do the things that we want to do.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Mm-hmm.
So it was like figuring out how to tour without having to go play 85, 110 shows a year or whatever.
Yeah, you said at that last show in San Francisco that you guys were fried, and there was a podcast, and you were like, I don't even know if that might be our last show.
We weren't sure. I was pretty sure we weren't going to just stop making music, but we just, at that point, we couldn't. We just knew we needed to not do it for a while.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Not make music, but just get away from all of it. That whole summer was like crazy. Just think about it. Dan had a baby.
Mm-hmm.
We went to Europe like 4 times.
Mm-hmm.
We did we just were doing random weekends and festivals.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it was fun, but it was also like, there was no, that was off year, and we did like 25 shows, and it ate up the whole summer.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So if you're like trying to work on a record or something, it's hard to find like a 2 or 3 week gap.
Yeah.
Where there's nothing getting in the way constantly.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's what we figured out how to do it, for at least for now.
During the break, did you guys like miss each other, or what was it like?
I mean, we'd start texting.
Yeah, we stayed in touch. We were texting.
Yeah, yeah.
We probably went, there was probably a 6 month period where we didn't really communicate much, but
mm-hmm.
I mean, you have to remember, I mean, from 2002 until 2015, there was 1 year where Dan put out a solo record in 2009, and that was like a year where we took a break.
Right.
But in that year where we took a break, we made a hip hop record.
Right.
We made Brothers. We played probably 40 shows.
Yeah.
But that was like a slow year. So even every year, we had been working together nonstop.
Yeah.
There's a lot of stuff that I learned on this break too. One of them was just how fucked up the music industry is when you end up working on something that you're proud of and just trying to figure out how to, like, in other words, like, Dan and I have it kind of easy because we're motivated together to work.
Mm-hmm.
So even when we didn't have a good record deal or anything, we would still just get in the van and make it fucking happen.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, we lost money all the time.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, we drove from Akron to New York City to open up for a ska band for $50.
Uh-huh.
And then we drove right back to Akron. We didn't even stay in New York.
Yeah, we were playing.
You didn't stay for the ska band?
We were playing Barclays.
I don't know. I mean, I think we had to because we had to wait to get paid.
Yeah, it was right. It was like 4 blocks from the Barclays.
Wow.
It was our first show in New York.
Wow.
Yeah, we drove 8.5 hours and then played and then drove 8.5 hours straight back.
Wow.
But it was really nice. I mean, that's like, I'm talking to certain new bands and like trying to figure out how to do it. And I was just like, man, like, we would just sleep in a fucking minivan.
Yeah. The car on the cover of El Camino.
That's not the actual one, but yeah, it's the same year model.
Right.
It's a 94 Plymouth. Mine was navy blue with the wood trim.
We strapped stuff to the top on our first tour.
Really?
Yeah, I brought enough clothes for like 6 months.
Yeah, I remember when we went to
And I'm like, wait, I'm not going to need all these, I don't think.
When we went to go, my brother came, we went to go pick him up, and Dan had like this bag. We were like, dude. Like,
I brought a duffel bag. It was like stood up like that tall.
We were like, no, bro. But my brother and I, our parents were divorced. We had to switch houses every week. We're like, no, man, you need like a third of that. But also, that's like when you're like 21, like, I don't know. I certainly didn't pack enough socks because at one point, like, I was wearing the same socks for 4 days and
we made Michael, Pat's brother, just get rid of his socks.
Yeah.
Really? We had to vacate
them. They literally hung them on a tree like an ornament. They were
in Seattle.
Yeah.
What was the longest drive you guys ever did?
We've done a couple of long drives that were for the record books. Uh-huh. We did a straight through overnight. Well, it was a full day, really, 24 hours, Austin to Akron. That was after the second time we played South by Southwest, and mm-hmm. we went down there, and it was such a waste of fucking time.
Yeah, why?
I mean, the first time we went to South by Southwest, it was 2003, mm-hmm. and we had our second record coming out like a couple weeks later. And we went there, and we met a promoter in Australia who ended up taking us over there. Mm-hmm. BT. We
got free Levi's.
We got free Levi's. We played the Fader Fort for 8 people. like all this fake news bullshit. We played all these shows, and ultimately what we got of it was like a write-up in the Enemy saying that we were opiate addicts.
Really?
But we did get this Australian tour, which ended up met this guy BT, who ended up becoming a really close friend and mm-hmm. us. But really, like, we got what we could of out of there. Yeah, and we went back the second year, and it was just like there's nothing there for us. And we could tell pretty quickly that it was just a complete waste of time.
Yeah.
And so that's why we did a 24-hour drive straight through, because we wanted to get the fuck home.
Jesus.
Yeah.
So you mentioned that one thing you learned in the 3-year break is how fucked up the music business is now. What did you mean when you said
that? Well, I meant specifically, like, there's always someone there that has to, there's a gatekeeper everywhere, you know what I mean? Yeah. You think at some point, like, you can get past that mm-hmm. aspect, and you should be able to. Mm-hmm. But, you know, when you work on a record, and I'd say at this point, like, we've made enough records between the two of us and on our own to know what the fuck we're doing, mm-hmm. that you'd think that it would be easy when you make something you're proud of to get, like, a label to get behind it. And it's not that easy.
Right.
So that's like, it just reminds me that when our whole career has been kind of like, even when we haven't been able to find a label, we would just, or find a situation that worked for us, we would still just work. We'd be able to figure it out somehow.
Well, you had major people coming after you for your first record, or your second record, and you turned it down because you didn't want to really, I mean, you had a bad feeling about it, it sounds like. You see, you wanted to go with Fat Possum.
Well, we were being approached by, like, different labels. I mean, right when our first record came out, within 2 weeks, we got an email from some dude at Atlantic.
Yeah.
First A&R guy to reach out to us. And he's like, send me your album. And I was like, send me $10, bitch. Like, what the fuck? I remember that. It was like, we didn't have any money. I was, like, living in squalor. This guy's, like, an A&R guy in New York mm-hmm. City. Like, fuck you. Go mm-hmm. fuck about. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of what we've learned that first year. It was like people kept coming out with this carrot, like dangling the carrot in front of us, but they didn't realize that, like, we were so malnourished that, like, right. if we were to eat that carrot, we would, like, get sick. Yeah. We needed, like, something other than, like, fucking carrot. There's not, like, the difference between $1,000 and $100,000 to us at that time was, like, mm-hmm. it was, like, the difference between, I mean, someone could have offered us $1 million. It would have been just as impressive as $10,000. Yeah. We had no fucking money.
Wow.
But I guess we figured out pretty quickly, like, that the last thing we needed was a label that couldn't even issue us a contract within a period of time that they stated they could. Mm-hmm. Because mm-hmm. they definitely wouldn't be able to put our record out.
Right.
So we went with Fat Possum, which was, like, so comfortable for us because Matthew and Bruce are great dudes and really eccentric characters. And, you know, like, the first record deal that we got, like, from them was for $12,000 mm-hmm. to make a record. That's, like, all the money. So we did it ourselves and pocketed the cash so we could pay our rent.
Right.
And in the meantime of, like, us getting that contract, they were trying to sell us cars. They're like, there's a 78 Mercedes that's got, like, 3 or 4 bullet holes to the windshield. I'll throw that in if we take $2,500 off of the off the contract.
Bruce always had Mercedes. Used Mercedes.
But it was perfect for us because then it was like...
Well, our heroes were on that label.
Yeah.
Right, right.
I mean, you know, that was our biggest influence when we started. Like, one of them was T-Model and Spam. I mean, it's like...
T-Model Ford.
Yeah, T-Model Ford and Spam. And he was on Fat Possum.
Who was he for people who don't know?
He was a musician from Greenville, Mississippi, and he played as a two-piece.
Mm-hmm.
Electric guitar and drums, and his drummer's name was Spam.
Uh-huh.
And they used to come through Cleveland all the time.
Yeah.
Used to see him. Yeah. But they had, like, you know, R.L. Burnside, who we loved, and Junior Kimbrough, who we loved, and T-Model, and Hassel Atkins,
mm-hmm.
and just...
And John Spencer Blues Explosion had done some stuff with R.L.
Right.
Yeah. So it was like a no-brainer for us.
Yeah.
I mean, we'd sent Fat Possum our first demo, and they just never even responded.
Yeah.
But, yeah, we were stoked to be on the label.
So I want to take a moment and talk about Vivid Seats. Staying at home is great, but eventually you just got to get out of the house. Whether you go out to see your favorite band or go cheer on your favorite team in person, you got to get out of the house. You got to have a night out. And with Vivid Seats, you can attend the concert of your choice, the sports event of your choice, whatever event you're looking for at a great price. Vivid Seats is the top source for tickets for all the live events you might want to go to. On their site, you can sort by price or look for seats in the section and row of your choice. You can pick the seat you want. To make things even better, Vivid Seats is giving listeners an exclusive promo code for new customers to receive 10% off your first ticket order to save even more money. Just go to the App Store or Google Play and download the Vivid Seats app. First-time customers can use promo code Rolling Stone. That's R-O-L-L-I-N-G-S-T-O-N-E for 10% off your first Vivid Seats order. Every purchase is backed by a 100% buyer guarantee. From the biggest concerts and games to the hottest theater and more, Vivid Seats has it all. Download the app and enter promo code Rolling Stone for 10% off your first order on Vivid Seats. Make a memory that lasts a lifetime and let Vivid Seats help you get to your favorite live event.
But you guys grew up around the corner from each other, is that?
Yeah, like a block from each other, yeah.
And what's your first memory of Pat?
I mean, I think, I don't know, I remember him from the school bus, I think, or like, probably throwing acorns or something.
We had this kid in the neighborhood I was friends with. He was in my grade, but Pat was younger. So,
I was like,
of course, he got bullied.
I was a mark.
But this, my friend was like, he was like 6'5" and like 250 pounds.
In like sixth grade.
Sixth grade. Yeah.
There was this kid that used to hang around the neighborhood, got arrested for killing someone as a cop.
Really?
He got off the hook, but then he got fired again for making like a prisoner dance for his food. That kid used to torment the shit out of me. Yeah.
He lived up the street.
He lived up the street.
Really?
Uh-huh.
He lived, that's when we kind of first met each other. It was getting like... me and my brothers and some of the younger kids getting picked on by, definitely not Dan, but by like some of the neighborhood kids. Mm-hmm. But we would get together and trade baseball cards. And I was really wanted to be liked, so I would put together deals that were really not in my favor. I was really popular for a couple of weeks. Right when I moved up there, they're like, man, Pat, yeah, bring your cards over, just hang out.
And is the first musical connection between you guys when, Dan, you were playing in a cover band and Pat came and recorded you? Is that a true story?
It was before that.
It was before that, I think.
Okay.
Yeah, no, that was just one of the times that we recorded our demo a little bit later on.
Uh-huh.
But before that, yeah, this is before I think it was before I played out in a bar. It was like before I was doing any of those gigs.
It was definitely before that.
Yeah. It was like really when we were just learning.
Yeah.
I'd just gotten my PV amp,
mm-hmm.
you know, and same amp that T-Model played, you know, and brought it down to Pat's house with my telly, and we played.
I've got recordings of that.
What does it sound like?
I mean, it kind of sounds just like we do now.
Sort really?
Of, but just like it's a lot sloppier. Yeah.
It sounds like it could fall apart at any second.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sounds like the first
Which record. Is awesome. Yeah, it's fragile.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I mean, is that when you found your sound or did it take a lot to get your sound?
No, it's always just right there.
It was there, yeah, you can hear this thing. It's just like, it's very dynamic.
But we always loved recording. I mean, Pat introduced me to the 4-track, but I was instantly fell in love with it. I mean, but it was like the idea of making tapes. We just loved that, making CDs.
You're right.
Making shit sound fun. Making an album. Just loved the idea of having an album. You know, we loved records so much, all we wanted to do was have a record.
Right.
You know, that's why when we ended up doing our first record deal, I mean, we didn't even know what the deal said. We just kind of signed it and, like, we were just excited to have a record.
Right.
Yeah, I remember looking at our first record deal and not really understanding anything, but understanding that it was, that they weren't going to give us any money
mm-hmm.
and that they would give us 50 records.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that time it was like, we weren't planning on, you know.
We'd never played a show.
We never even really knew we were going to play shows. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. You guys are amazing live band, but
I mean, I don't know that we would even be we wouldn't even be a band maybe if that guy hadn't put out our record.
Yeah.
Patrick Boisel.
Yeah.
We sent him a demo out of the blue. He'd never met us, and he said, "Send me 10 songs, I'll put out your record." And that's what started the Black Keys. Yeah, because before that, we didn't exist. We only created the name The Black Keys to put on the demos to send to the couple labels that we sent it out to.
And there were only three labels that wrote back that wanted to do something. And it was
Estrus,
Chicken Ranch in Austin, Texas. Estrus said if we drove to Bellingham, that we
Bellingham, Washington, yeah.
That they would take an audition, basically.
We've never left Ohio, so we're just...
Do you think you would have started the band now with the music business being the way it is, with less opportunities now, or is it...
I mean, the way I look at the way, you know, the shit started for us, it was like, it was at independent record stores.
Yeah.
There was no radio play for us. Our first big, meaningful piece of press came from actually Rolling Stone.
Mm-hmm.
From a review on our first record, 4-star review.
Oh, wow.
Peter Relic wrote it.
From Peter Relic.
Yeah.
Who lives in Charleston.
Oh, really?
I mean, I wouldn't hesitate to start a band now. No.
Yeah.
I just think it is...
I think it's a good time now.
I think it
really?
Would probably be... It would be... you'd be ahead of the curve.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, the biggest mistake bands make is, like, looking for some big record deal that's going to get them radio play and all this kind of stuff. It just it doesn't exist.
Mm-hmm.
I mean... Like, even a band like The Strokes, who, I, you know, like, such an exciting band. Like, when they first came out, it was, like, one of the more inspiring things and well-needed at the time because it was right after 9/11, like, when that first record came out. And but leading up that summer before was, like, the lowest point of my adult life.
Why?
Up to that point. I just was unemployed. It was fucking miserable. And I got laid off, and the economy in Akron was terrible.
Mm-hmm.
I hated school. Dan hated school. And that's the moment, that summer, 2001, end of the summer, is when we accidentally started the band.
Yeah.
And at that same moment, like, The Strokes' first record was coming out, and they never got played on the fucking radio, at least not in Ohio.
It took forever for them to even go gold, even though everyone was talking about it.
Yeah. And I think that is something that people lose sight of, is, like, that's really, like, and that's the most successful type of alternative rock.
Yeah.
Thing, you know what I mean? It's never been about getting platinum or diamond albums in that genre. It's about influencing. It's like the Ramones have one gold record, and their greatest hits came out in the 90s. And that's because people were buying records then.
Right.
But how influential are the bands like that? The thing that I get frustrated about is that record labels lose sight of that themselves. They forget sometimes that, like, you know, there's a lot of musicians who are influenced by these bands, and, like, Captain Beefheart or Tom Waits or whatever the fuck it might be, that for the most part not super commercially viable entities. And I think that for Dan and I, music is the most important thing in our lives. It's changed our lives.
Yeah.
It's the thing that, like, Dan, like this is Dan's life. You're sitting in it. It's just all fucking music everywhere.
Yeah.
I mean, you go to my house, my house is the same thing. I'm married to a woman too. So life's the same way. Just all music. And so we view music like art.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And I think that there's this way where, like, I also think that you should find a way, there's a path to be able to support yourself making your art. Of course, not everybody's going to be able to do it. And some people make terrible fucking art.
Yeah.
But I do think that's, like, the hope as a kid. It's like, maybe I can have a band and, like, we could, like, tour, maybe pay our rent.
Mm-hmm.
Like, but, and even then, like, when we were teenagers, it was, like, kind of like you were considered, like, a fucking dick if you wanted to even make money off of your music.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that's the confusing intersection here, is that, like, we want support. We want to find, like, a way to, like, I want to be able to turn on the radio and hear cool stuff, even if it's just, like, a small little independent station.
Yeah.
And I want to be able to support artists like that in a way that's, like, somewhat meaningful.
Yeah.
And the success on that kind of stuff that we're in talking about, it's like, you know, people just supporting themselves, you know? And that's why when you go to have a meeting with, like, a big label, they're only interested in stuff that might sell millions of copies or something. And that, to me, most of that shit's terrible, so.
Yeah, when you turn on the radio, what do you think? Pop radio?
I mean, even when I was a kid, I hated pop radio.
Yeah, really?
I mean, I hear, like, Lionel Richie and get fucking depressed.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? My dad's playing the Beatles and stuff. You know, I could tell it was, like, it was terrible.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, Dancing on the Ceiling is not a good song. I mean,
right.
I'm not an asshole for saying that. I mean, like, in fact, I'd say, you know, I don't know. I didn't grow up listening to that kind of stuff. Like, I would hear it, you know.
I went and saw Whitney Houston.
Did you really?
At Blossom Music Center with my mom.
And what was it like?
Moms are always getting in the way of dudes music.
I remember it was amphitheater. We were in the grass, and I just remember I could see like a little like neon green person jumping around on stage.
So when you guys put out Attack and Release, which was an incredible album that got a lot of attention, and then Brothers, and then you're in the world of pop music, and you're on.
We're not in the world of pop.
You're on the MTV Video Music Awards, and you're at.
We were like breakthrough video. You know what that is? That means like we're gonna try to utilize whatever kind of little clout this band has for a minute on YouTube.
Yeah.
To give them a fucking award.
Well, but what is it like when you're in that world and on that level with those people and talking to them?
It's like you're a spy in the middle of Russia, like trying to not blow your fucking cover.
Really?
Yeah. It's like, oh, I love your music. It's great. Fucking love it.
Yeah.
I'm like, yeah. I don't know. I love that.
Are you talking about like award shows specifically?
Yeah. Well, I'm just wondering if you guys
did a video game award show one time. We met.
Hulk Hogan.
He was telling us how he used to run up and down the East Coast playing rock and roll.
He was a musician, right?
Something like, these fingers never touched a fret or something. Like, he was like, he finally played a fretless bass. I was like, that's fucking crazy.
He was so nice.
Really?
Very nice.
Who are the weirdest people you met like that? Hulk Hogan is like more important than...
You know who we met one time in England was that guy with no teeth at the bar?
Shane McGowan.
Oh, I love the Pogues.
He was rich.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wasted?
He looked like he was going to melt.
Honestly, yeah. It was like...
He looked like a melted candle.
This was one of our first trips over to England, and we were at this place called the Boogaloo.
He did.
And our tour manager was like, tapped me on the shoulder, and I was like 20, you were like 23 years old.
Yeah.
We were babies. Yeah. This guy was like, look next to you. And I was like, it was like... I got scared straight, like right there. He was like, he is drinking three drinks. He had a gin and tonic, a beer, and a White Russian. And it's actually like, if you watch the Alan Partridge show, it's a British show.
Mm-hmm.
He orders in the show, this character, Alan Partridge, goes to the bar. It's like, he meets these two women, and he's like, what can I get you? And she's like, I'll have a gin and tonic. She said, I'll have a White Russian. And he's like, and he goes and orders himself a beer and these two drinks, right?
Yeah.
And he comes back and the girls are gone. So he just drinks them all together through three straws.
All Brothers was all like slower songs. And then El Camino, it's an incredible record where you are, it's fast and like a Phil Spector record or something.
I haven't listened to it in years.
What, really? But I mean, can you tell me about the making of that record? Because that's just one of my favorite records of yours.
We made that. Here.
Yeah.
Some, right? Mostly? I don't know.
El Camino?
Yeah.
It's all done
Brian?
Here.
Real.
All here, all February, March, April, 2011.
Yeah.
We were supposed to be in Australia for half of it. We canceled this tour and called Brian, like, all last minute, right after we played SNL for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
Dan had just finished this spot. He had just finished it, like, a week before we started the record.
Wow.
And we came in and just... Really, we were just decompressing from the road because we've been on the road all
year. We were at road speed.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so that's what it sounds
tempos
like.
Tempos are fast, right?
Yeah. But it's great. That's why it's great.
Mm-hmm.
And you still play a lot of those songs live now. What it means that because you guys were going so fast.
We were on tour so much, we were definitely in the mood to try to come up with some songs that we can play.
Yeah.
That we can add to the set.
Yeah. It's like all singles in a great way.
Yeah, I don't...
And I feel like the new record is a combination of all of that, like everything that you guys have done. Like there's some Turn Blue kind of stuff, and there's some stuff that's like El Camino, and like, you guys have sort of a full sounding record.
Mm-hmm.
What did you want to do with this record?
We wanted to not overthink it.
Yeah.
We didn't really talk about it, but we just started with just drums and guitar, and then we kind of finished six songs or so, and then we hadn't added any other instruments, so we just decided then to just keep it guitar and drums and bass and just... Simple.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think we were probably in a similar frame of mind as we were when we made El Camino, to be honest.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We were kind of like ready to, you know, play some rock and roll.
And Turn Blue is such an interesting record. You don't have another one that sounds like it. And it's, I think, for real, a lot of real fans that love that record. Mm-hmm. And I'm just curious, how do you look back on it?
Honestly, I don't remember anything about it.
Why?
Well, I remember being in California recording it, but I don't remember anything else about it, to be honest.
Really?
I mean, I'd have to go back and listen to it.
Okay.
I need a refresher.
You bet, yeah.
But I mean, you know, we toured for how many years and played the songs how many times, and then when we got back together for rehearsals, like, I had no idea how to play any of our songs again. I needed to be reminded.
Yeah.
They came back quick, but like...
Yeah.
Yeah.
So if someone put you in a room and said, can you play?
No, I mean, we hired you know, guys who play with us, and they learned.
Okay, you guys have to learn new songs. I'm like, how does this go?
Wow.
We've always done it that way, though, to be honest.
Yeah.
Because we've never been that band that, like, sets up and, like, rehearses, you mm-hmm. know? Like, mm-hmm. it just isn't.
We don't rehearse.
You know?
We don't rehearse. We don't.
It's like Kenny Powers when he says, I don't want to be the best at working out.
Like, yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, that's kind of how we've looked at it.
Rubber Factory, I mean, that the place that you recorded that album is, the vibe you got out of that is wild.
Yeah, that was just the old General Tire Factory.
Yeah.
The second floor, that's where all offices were. The first floor had like the 40-foot ceilings mm-hmm. where they were like melting down mm-hmm. metal mm-hmm. below us. Yeah. That's why it was always warm in the studio in the wintertime because they would melt. They were melting like steel below.
It was so weird, actually, when I think back about it. It's almost like there's this...
It was depressing as hell.
There's a soap opera called Passions.
Dude. We used to go to this...
What's that?
We used to go to that restaurant every day.
The Lamp Post.
The Lamp Post Diner, and it was this guy and his mom there, and no one else was ever there.
There's one guy that was kind of like a human adult pig pen that was just covered in filth and drove this dirty truck. Did you remember this guy? Jake Jeepers Creepers?
Yeah.
He was kind of there, too. Never to say anything.
Dude, can you imagine looking at what was on those plates right now?
Dude, when I think back about this as being that building, it's almost like, dude, there's a show, it's a soap opera called Passions, which like I completely forgot about. Someone's like, you should look at this clip on YouTube, and it was like this doll coming to life. And I'm like, what the fuck is this? This is like familiar, like I've seen this. It's like so fucking scary, I can't handle it.
Yeah.
But it was like, we were in this giant building and there were holes in the floor. You look, remember that? You can look down through the floor. There's stacks of tires, like mm-hmm. Al Capone's vault. No one in this building, a million square feet.
No one there.
Dude, toxic chemicals everywhere, asbestos.
And how did you wind up recording it?
Because it was the only place we could afford.
Oh.
Because we just had like a couple $100 coming in every few weeks from playing shows. The smart thing would have for us to have bought a little cheap house or something, but we didn't have that kind of, we didn't have even have a couple $1,000, I don't think, to do that, but.
Or the smarts.
The smarts.
What could you have not prepared for when you, with success? I mean, because I was watching that thing and we were talking about Billy Corgan, and he said he had no one to talk to once they got success.
Yeah, because he didn't give any of this publishing to his band.
Yeah.
So I fucking hated him.
Like, yeah.
Of course he had no one to talk to. He's a fucking greedy prick. I don't know.
Yeah.
I guess. I mean, ooh. Honestly, the hardest thing is that when I say something like that,
God damn it.
I mean, I'm just saying, like, that's the thing about a band is this. It's like, this is the problem.
Yeah.
It's a shared community.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, if Dan and I make a song, sometimes Dan makes like 98% of the song.
Yeah.
I mean, we share the publishing in a way that is not 98% in his favor.
Yeah.
I mean, sometimes when we plan a business move, it's like 98% my idea.
Right.
But it is set up in a way where it's not that way. It is a community thing.
Yeah.
Where you're working together for the greater good of things. When you're doing a drive and Dan sleeps at night and I drive at night.
Yeah.
That's a band. It is a very unique partnership.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So throughout this entire experience, like, the most important thing is that Dan and I feel like we're both being fair to each other.
Mm-hmm.
And that's called respect.
Right.
You know what I mean? And that can make a relationship last like a long, long time. So whatever I just said about Billy Corgan, it was a joke.
Right.
But it is like a band will fall apart the minute that respect level disintegrates.
Right.
And the worst thing you can do is not treat, if someone's getting financially rewarded in a way that outweighs the rest of the band, that band will implode.
Yeah.
It is a fucking known fact.
Yeah.
Any manager should recognize that. Any band should be taught that because you can accomplish so much more as a band because there's a mythology behind a band. You know what I mean? Like when Trey Anastasio he plays the Ryman. When Fish plays, they play the Bridgestone.
Yeah.
Because there's this history, there's this thing, there's more than the sum of its parts.
Yeah.
So I think to answer your question about what I wasn't expecting with success, I still am not used to the idea that I can pay for, like, shit all the time.
Yeah.
Blows my mind.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
So the tour is, you're about a month in, and what does it feel like to be up there every night after a month of pretty heavy touring?
It feels amazing.
Yeah.
It really almost feels better than ever.
Really?
Yeah. It's just like, I don't know. We've just kind of settled into the playing, and it just feels really good.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I agree. I think it feels better than it ever has.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Especially yeah. better than, yeah. Yeah.
I know that seems crazy, but it really does. I don't know what it is. It's just having a couple of those old Ohio friends there and, you know, just the way that we're able to play on stage with the three guitars, drums, and bass. It's just like extra Black Keys for some reason. I don't know.
Yeah. What do you think is going to happen? I mean, if you look at the touring Polestar top tours, it's like Elton John, the Rolling Stones, and Springsteen. There's you guys, but like a lot of them are like over 70. Like what's it going to be like in 10 years?
Well, they keep making the kind of money they're making, they're going to be over 80.
Yeah. Yeah. What is it going to be like in 15 or 20 years? Like you guys will be touring and.
You know what? I would pay a lot of money to see Led Zeppelin play.
Do you think they ever would do it again?
I don't know. Yeah. But I think that also I'd pay money to see. I saw Elton John a couple of times. I'm not even like a huge Elton John fan for sure. I didn't grow up. My dad didn't really listen to him much, but I still love his show. And Rolling Stones show is still good. And I think it is like, who knows what? Hopefully, when we're 25 years from now, people still come see us.
And that is our show for today. We'll be back next week here on Sirius XM's Volume Channel 106. In the meantime, Rolling Stone Music Now is a podcast. Download us as a podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Subscribe to us as a podcast. Maybe leave us a nice review on iTunes. That is always appreciated. Even if you leave a mean, crazy one, I'll read that too. But as always, thanks for listening. Happy New Year, and we will see you next week.